Thank you to Maha and Greg. So, we'll just get straight in. We are running behind. This panel, this session is going to be me asking a few questions and then inviting you to join in. Our panellists are starting at the end, Joshua Gans, who is the Foundation Professor of Management, Information Economics at the Melbourne Business School. He's Managing Director also of Core Research, which is a consulting firm. And it says here he was awarded the Economic Society of Australia's Young Economist of the Year Award in 2007, which is fantastic. Well done. Mark Scott has the unique distinction of being my boss twice. Firstly at Fairfax.
Still learning.
Firstly at Fairfax and now the ABC. So
I follow you wherever you go, Alan. You know.
You can't stay away from me.
No, I can't.
But I'll give you a very easy time. Not. Next to him is Henry Ergas, a paid consultant of Telstra, as you've heard. Henry, sorry. He doesn't say that himself. Henry is managing director of the, founder and managing director of Network Economics Consulting Group, and currently chairman of Concept Economics. Sitting next to me is Mark Porter, who has already been introduced. So look, I thought it was a fascinating morning. And I thought I'd start with Mark, if that's possible. And just because you're a provider of content, online broadband, I notice a huge amount of programming is now. Every time I watch the 7:30 report, they say if you want to see the whole interview, go and look online on the website. The question is, I guess, is are you getting frustrated? Are you being held back at all right now?
Yeah, I think we are. And part of that is that the ABC's reach is to in all parts of the country. And we have made a commitment to use online opportunities to connect with more Australians in more ways more often. And so we're creating this great content and we want to deliver it to our audiences in a time they want, in a format that they want. And we're quite innovative. We've always been innovative. When radio started in Australia, only 6% of Australians had a radio licence and the ABC was broadcasting. When TV started, only 1% of Australians had a TV set. We've started iView, Australia's first internet television service, but it needs fast broadband to work properly. So half the population can experience it in a satisfactory way, but half the audience can't. And it's very important to the ABC because we are more important as a broadcaster in regional and rural Australia than anywhere else. When I started at the ABC, we started a fabulous service called unearth.com.au that allows unsigned musicians to upload music to a website where it can be heard and sampled and then downloaded and streamed. And we had to pull back the capability of that site because whilst it worked very well in metropolitan areas, it would drive people to despair in regional and rural centres. So we are building a future of the ABC about delivering and collecting our content to audiences where they want, on a time they want, in a format they want, and for that we need fast broadband, and we're not there now, and we live in anticipation of an Australia that can deliver that for us.
Joshua, if we can just move on now to sort of the fundamental questions, and I'll bring Henry in a moment on this issue. Of the question is, you know, whether this national broadband network really is a bottleneck piece of infrastructure, is it a natural monopoly or not? Or do we have two Australias where, you know, in the cities it's not, it's competitive, in the rural areas it is a natural monopoly, and that we need two policies?
Well, I think that pretty much indicates not just the situation in broadband, but in every infrastructure service that we have. And the same dichotomy exists around the world. The way we've traditionally dealt with this in telecommunications is to say, if you are going to be the national provider in the cities, then you should be the national provider elsewhere, and we should have a complicated situation of regulation, cross subsidies, etc., to somehow keep you solvent or keep you going through that. That's a bad way to go. When it comes down to it, part of the issue here is that we speak of broadband as if it were roads, as if it were water, as if it were some critical piece of infrastructure. I'm not 100% convinced of that, but If that is indeed the case, we should actually fund it as if it were like that. We already know that we have high-speed broadband capabilities where the market can bear it right now, and we could get more of it if we weren't caught up in this current tender process that is, I'm pretty sure, chilling investment. If we were really serious about this, what we would do is we would, in fact, identify the areas where it's going to be hard to get broadband and subsidise the connections directly and not prescribe fibre to the node or any other capabilities to get them there, but just to offer essentially a prize for every customer you can connect. That would be the efficient way to do this. Countless studies in the US have shown that is when these services get rolled out most efficiently. And I think the problem is that there's a reason to be pessimistic in this, is that in telecommunications, every time the federal government, regardless of political party, has had a choice between saving itself or earning itself some money versus promoting competition, it's gone for the money. And there are choices here where it could easily go for the money rather than go for the competition. And we're seeing this in the shackle process it currently is now. And it's bundling up this entire issue of the last percent of the Australian population. The one thing that's good about Telstra's 13-page proposal is it highlights and lays down the gauntlet on precisely that issue. And I think that's economic facts that the government has to face.
Henry, do you want to address the sort of the fundamental issue of whether it is... Because you, I think, are in favour of light regulation, allowing more efficiency and competition. So the question is whether that is appropriate for the whole of Australia and whether it will work in this instance.
Well, I think you need to distinguish between really the metropolitan areas on the one hand and the non-metropolitan areas on the other, recognising that that's actually to some extent a continuum. But in the metropolitan areas, clearly what we have already is a diversity of wireline providers going from the copper network through to hybrid fibre coax providers. And in those areas, there is, in my view, no reason why broadband service, be it through FTTN or through HFC, could not be commercially viable. And what you would need to do, I believe, with respect to those areas, and indeed generally, is get the policy framework right, get the access regime right, create a situation where, in fact, there are incentives to make large sunk investments, which is not the case at the moment with an access regime which is very discretionary and intrusive. So get the access regime right, get the regulatory and policy framework right, and then if the upgrading of the network to FTTN is efficient, it will occur in that framework. With respect to non-metropolitan areas, there you have problems of lower density and hostile geographies. But in my view, there too, there are over time relatively strong prospects for competition associated with development of wireless technologies. And what concerns me there in respect of those areas is if you transplant the regulatory model that we have at the moment, where you enforce uniform prices so that prices in non-metropolitan areas are forced well below cost, then competing alternatives will never develop because they'll be competing against what are in fact subsidized, usually cross-subsidized service provision. And for those areas, in my view, and here I would agree with Joshua, I think the sensible thing to do is to separately identify USO funding. And if you want to ensure widespread provision of service, and then to the greatest extent possible, make that universal service funding contestable and make it contestable on a basis that allows for diversity, not merely of suppliers, but also over the long run of technologies that they use.
Michael, I actually think that in some ways your kind of four digital doors idea is the kind of core of the issue. If I was a non-Telstra bidder for the national broadband network, I'd be terrified of the other three, or the two of the doors at least. You've got copper, wireless, hybrid fibre, coax and fibre, which is the fibre to the node. I actually don't know why anyone would bid, really, because, as Greg said, the wireless is 14.4 megabits a second, going to 21, going to 42, going to 1 gig, right? So that'll be a fixed, that can be a perfectly good fixed line service. HFC could be easily rolled out. Telstra, and there's no way the government can, if I can, this is a massively long question, there's no way the government is going to be able to prevent that, you know, whatever they do, they'll be, that will be done.
Well, my understanding about mobiles as a platform for all broadband in the future is that once, if everybody wants to do all their data through their mobile phone, then you're going to have to be expanding. There's going to be lumps on every telegraph pole or every street. And when you work out the cost of that, it's actually more expensive than fiber. So my understanding is that pervasive use of mobiles is no alternative to fiber optic. It's a fantastic complement to fiber optic. It means when you leave home, you can really download. As I can now with my iPhone, it's pretty good. You can get some documents. But it does get awfully slow at times if you're in an area where there's lots of people. So I think mobiles are not a replacement for fiber. And my point about the HFC cable is that the elephant in the room, I'm afraid, is Telstra. It's been a nurtured elephant. It's a great elephant. It's got some fantastic progeny. I love elephants. But damn it, I want the elephant to perform better. I want it to start trotting, not clogging, and I don't want it to tread on me.
Mark, if you were on the expert panel assessing the bids, I know you haven't read the bids, but would you want Telstra doing it?
I'd be far too wise to answer that question, Alan. I have my own funding bid before government at the moment, and have thought it best not to wade in on behalf of the ABC and provide commentary. We do have a clear stake in it, though. And I think the bundling and the separation is an issue that we look at. You know, we read in the paper the other day, is Telstra really Australia's fourth network? And we already have some compelling evidence about how access to networks and pricing of access to networks affects traffic. 5% of the visits to ABC Online come from iiNet. 31% of the visits to our iView site come from iiNet because it is free of charge outside the cap, and so people can go to that site and access it with confidence they're not going to run up big bills. And so that 31% is vastly disproportionate to iiNet's presence in the ISP market. And so we're concerned and very interested that if in fact Telstra was delivering this service, that we would have clear and complete access, that we would not find ourselves in a disadvantage in having access of our content compared to, say, what Big Pond might be offering, and that the user charges that might come back to us that we can't monetise through advertising don't put us at a significant disadvantage. So we're watching it all closely. We clearly have a major stake in it, but we're not providing ongoing commentary.
Well, let me just ask a further follow-up question. Do you think that Australia is better off or worse off for Telstra not having started building the fibre to the node 3 years ago?
Well, I think as of today, we would be in a vastly preferable position as far as the ABC is concerned if more of our suite of services that we've rolled out that work out very well in Sydney and Melbourne and Brisbane could be utilised all around the country. And we absolutely have experience of the tyranny of distance that I think, you know, has been identified today. When I started at the ABC, I was told that 92% of digital transmission had been rolled out. Sorry, that 50% of digital transmission had been rolled out, and that was reaching 92% of the country. And the next 50% needed to be rolled out. That would reach another 6% of the country, and only 98% was going to be reached. So it's very, very difficult and very, very costly once you get beyond the major metropolitan centres. But would we like to be in a position today where iView could be experienced completely by all the Australians who pay for the ABC, not just the Australians in the major capital cities? Yes, we'd like to be in that position now.
Josh, the other elephant in the room is the global financial crisis. Do you think, given what's going on and the availability of money and capital at the moment, we can afford to have competition, infrastructure competition in telecommunications?
I think if you think about what that financial crisis means for the costs of providing all of this, all of the elements that were discussed regarding optic fibre, labour, and also, to some extent, financing, to the extent that it can come from governments, of which, at the moment, our federal government is more than willing to throw money at various things, what could be better than future infrastructure investment and bringing it forward? This looks like it might be an opportunity. It's an opportunity to, while the rest of the world slows down, for us to catch up. I must admit, as I sit and I listen to commercial people talk about broadband infrastructure investment, I come attracted to the idea that the government should just say no to all the bidders and, in fact, revisit it and simply build its own network over the top of it. And if it's true that you need a fully integrated provider who does it from end to end to be fully secure, then it should do the entire lot. There might be a case for that right now, given the current environment. It's certainly worth exploring as opposed to the regulatory morass that we clearly face. So I would much rather, you know, I know that is a view that is somewhat extreme at the moment, but we've seen a lot of extreme things occur in the last 6 months. But if anyone ever believes the figure that it's $30 billion per annum in GDP value to having high-speed broadband infrastructure, then actually spending $15 to $20 billion to overbuild the current Telstra network entirely, provide a completely new player in telecommunications and competition for the future, sounds cheap.
That is not the answer I expected. Anyway, okay, so someone else's turn. Any questions from the floor? Well, I wanted to give you a go. Phil.
Just a very quick perspective comment, I think, when you mentioned that the total invested assets in telecom today is just over $50 billion. I'm not sure when we look at these figures of 5 by 4 or 7, if we know what we're comparing it with. But all telecoms in Australia today have got a total asset base of $50 billion, which I think just puts some of your comments in perspective, Josh.
Did everyone hear that? No. Total invested telecom assets in Australia, $50 billion, which put Josh's comments into perspective.
Three mobile networks, two AT&T networks, one fixed line network.
There's actually
a lot of networks
in
$50 billion. Josh's
numbers
sound
right.
Right. So there's a lot of networks. Anyway, here you go.
Ian McGill from Allen. I just wondered a question for Michael Porter. What, with the four doors
that you referred to, what if Telstra was the winning bidder? What keeps the copper wire door open?
Well, I think actually a lot of copper will have to be turned off. The exchanges, I mean, there will be some traffic light and medical issues, but the fibre to the home will tend to be replaced by copper, my understanding. I know there's been some saying that's a terrible thing, and I know some of those have changed their tune. So we don't believe that the copper door should be shut all at once, but that there will be a way of opting out, and for most people in most streets, I think there'll be a replacement. And that's why we got very interested in the assets under the ground, the cable that's sort of largely wasted, because it does have huge possibilities in terms of technology. But given we have very heavy involvement of government, given that there are handouts, although Josh is now creating a new public sector model, it seems to me we can accept closure of some copper as the price.
Henry, can I just ask you, is Maha right in saying that that an NBN will result in the killing off of exchange-based in copper? I suppose it's just part of the same issue, really.
Well, if you pull them up and fibre to the node network, is that you would no longer have an unbundled local loop service. And if the competition that you're referring to is using the unbundled local loop service, then competition within the Telstra network using the unbundled local loop service would, indeed should, disappear. However, it's important to note two points. The first is that if anyone builds a fibre to the node network, and in particular if it's built using private sector funding in a commercial context, and as one of the people in the room who remembers the days of the PMG, I very much hope that if we have a fibre to the node network, it's not based on the PMG model. But if someone invests the sorts of money that would be required to build such a network, then they will have very strong incentives to encourage efficient use of that network. And if it is people other than Telstra who are going to provide those applications, and it's a Telstra network, then, believe me, Telstra will have very strong incentives to ensure that the Telstra network is a network of choice and that those applications are provided by those people, whoever they may be, on the Telstra network. And the second point is this, is that while you will not have unbundled local loop-based competition, you will continue to have and should continue to have facilities-based competition provided off other networks and platforms.
Full stop, ADSL is cheaper.
Yeah, great. Can Greg have the microphone?
I'll just use this. My reference point on fiber was not Australia-based, it was US-based. And, you know, it's simple. It doesn't matter what geography you're in. Anywhere around the world, if you're trying to build in populated areas, it's going to cost you more than in new construction areas. And that's the point. And it's very simple, the cost of fiber to the premise. And we have various examples here where we do it under commercial contracts with developers, that the cost of building all the way to the home, the fiber optics, optical terminal you have to use, those costs are entirely different than fiber to the node. So there is a cost differential. On the HFC, we actually upgraded Sydney and Melbourne, and we offer what's called cable extreme at 30 megabits. But we also, no, thank you. We appreciate your business. We want more of it. The thing that you may not be aware of, we did, I don't think it got picked up very much in the media, but we did do a trial in Sydney and a trial in Melbourne upgrading and running our HFC at 50 to 75 megabits and at 100 megabits in Melbourne, 50 to 75 in Sydney and 100 megabits on our HFC infrastructure. In the labs, we were running well over, very comparable to what's mentioned in the U.S., but we could do that. The reason we don't do it, and so could Optus. Optus has a very fine HFC network. The reason we don't is the regulatory environment. And again, it's pretty simple. There's a, you know, you can look that way and react that way. We have share owners that we have to answer to. And given all of the debate that you heard some of it today that's been in the news ever since this NBN process started, is if we're going to be forced to divest that asset, if that's what people think is going to happen, then with full knowledge, you wouldn't invest and upgrade your network when you're going to have to turn around and divest it. So until we get certainty, we wouldn't do it. But it is very easy to do. It does cost some money. The U.S. markets are doing it. Some European markets are doing it. And we can do it, and it's not that hard to do. They have several million homes passed, so do we. So it's just an issue of economics and regulatory environment.
Question, Alan, because
just very briefly,
that's another regulatory argument. Henry tried to run the regulatory argument that you wouldn't make a big investment because of the capricious nature of our regulatory environment. Now, it happens to be a fact the mobile networks aren't regulated, but they're covered by exactly the same capricious regulatory environment that Greg has suggested might be a factor in why they're not investing in HFC, but it didn't seem to stop them investing in mobile. So I'm trying to understand what is the trigger that makes the hypothetical regulatory environment that doesn't actually apply a risk to some investments but not others?
I'm not sure we're going to get an answer to that, but anyway.
I'm not sure.
That's what I said to you before, Greg. I mean, Michael Porter's about the only person in the country who's threatening to force you to divest HSC. I don't think anyone's talking about that. Can I also advance a proposition to all of the speakers, which is that it's actually to Australia's benefit that Optus doesn't use its HFC network, because, well, for, it doesn't compete fully in the way that as a broadband to provide broadband.
Yeah, they do. It's just that they're not extended.
Okay.
And they have very limited footprint.
We actually have over 30% customer penetration in the area
where we have broadband. He's saying they have 30% customer penetration
where there is the HFC.
It's actually a fallacy to say we don't compete. We offer services where we have an HFC footprint via HFC, broadband, telephony, etc. The key is we won't extend it past the 25%. There is no incentive, there's no reason commercially that we will extend it past 25%.
Well, what I was going to say was the reason for that is because it's cheaper to use ULL on regulated ULL on the copper, right?
I might ask why Telstra chose to invest in DSL rather than extend its HFC network. Because it is cheaper to run DSL networks than HFC networks.
Yeah, but what I'm saying is that that's the that keeps our prices down. If you guys got, you're spending too much on HFC, it's to our benefit. We're getting $30 a month broadband. As a result of that, we've got 64 or whatever it is percent penetration in this country because of low prices, which results from copper-based ULL.
I think
can I advance that proposition?
Well, of course you can advance any proposition you want, but especially since you're chairing the panel. but the point the point about it is that what you're doing is you're confusing the short run outcomes that come from highly distorted access prices with long-run competition and diversity in the market. Because there's no doubt that Optus was, and look, I don't particularly want to focus on Optus, but just to use it as an illustration of the point, Optus was expanding the number of customers both for telephony and for broadband on its own network until ULL prices were slashed by the ACCC. And that dramatic reduction in ULL prices had, amongst other things, the effect that Optus was put in a position where it was competing with access seekers who were using ULL at these very low prices. And at those prices, I believe it was entirely rational for Optus to then shift its focus from the continued growth of the HFC network, which of course had been its promise when John Howard made that fateful telephone call over the HFC Optus network in late 1996, shift from that to making ever more intensive use of ULL. Now, in the short run, of course, you know, if you reduce the price of an input and encourage the inexpensive use of that input, that will translate into output prices. If you declare BHP's rail line in the Pilbara and set the price at zero, presumably you will get other people using that rail link. And the effect of that will flow through. But the long-run effect of it is to discourage investment in that facility and to prevent the upgrading of that facility. And so even if there were a short-run benefit, as you say, then I believe that the arguments put by Martin Cave and Jeff Eisenach in this volume
and the evidence they present is compelling that those short-run benefits have been bought at a very high long-run cost.
Did you want to... we're just about out of time, but we've got time for...
That can't go unanswered.
Better give Maha a microphone.
Just a station break before a word from the regulator. Well, I've got to comment on that, Henry. The costing we've done on ULL was a long process and based on Telstra's own modelling to Pi 2. Now, it's true that it took us a long time to understand exactly how that cost model worked, but in the end, we got a pretty good understanding and we got to a set of prices that we think reflected cost. Telstra has challenged that view in the courts and before the Australian Competition Tribunal, and our view has been endorsed. So I think there's a strong case for saying that we have probably got a pretty good cost-based model there, and I don't think it's the product of a capricious regulator. In terms of the comparison with the cost of the HFC, I think it's an economic fallacy to value a natural monopoly network on the basis of the next-tech alternative, because I think on that basis what we'd be doing is valuing, say, an electricity network on the basis of how much it would cost every household to install a wind generator in the backyard. And clearly, that's just an economic nonsense. With natural monopoly infrastructure, what you do is you value access, and you value that network on the basis of the cost of that network, not on some notion of what the best alternative is. Because, by definition, if it's a natural monopoly network, that is going to be higher cost. It's going to be less efficient to use that infrastructure.
I don't think anyone's valuing it that way. I've never seen any attempt to value it that way, so I don't see the relevance of the point.
I really want to give someone else in the room a go, if we can. Thank you.
Thank you. Fred Chilton from Mellons. I'd like to take Mark Scott and the panel back to some of Mark's comments about access in rural areas. And is it not the case that the real issue about getting affordable broadband in country towns, or for that matter a state such as Tasmania, is the issue of reasonably priced competitive backhaul? And I suspect that now there is competition backhaul for Tasmania, that the prices on the Telstra network will dramatically reduce. That's understandable. If there's no competition, you get the maximum out of a market. How can the government regulate going forward to be able to ensure that we get that competitive backhaul and we get things like wireless competition in country towns and in states other than and places other than Sydney, Melbourne and Brisbane?
Anyone got a view on that?
I guess if you go with my Big Bang, build another network, you'll have that automatically. So simple, it's like yes, Prime Minister, really. But the alternative way is that you just basically have to target those areas and you have to offer a subsidy and see how that goes. Because we just do not know prescriptively what the best way to connect each individual customer is as we go outside the cities. It's even hard enough in the cities to work out how to match it with individual preferences that are also diverse. And so the market-based way to do this is to put the money up as a subsidy that's based on performance. And that's what we should be doing in rural and regional areas on this issue.
Just one here.
I'm just going to move the conversation away from regulation for a minute. Megan Brownlow from PricewaterhouseCoopers. I have a question for Dr. Porter. Why do you think IPTV is such a good thing?
I think TV is a good thing. Having a new, fast, reliable way, and it's technically complex, but having TV come to the house is great. I'd like to have had the privilege that they had in Canada of watching 8 events at once from the Olympics. We had sort of occasionally, Yahoo 7 condescended to let you have one. So what I believe IPTV, because of the speed of light, is going to be very powerful. And that's why I'm interested in getting competition. If we let the large, big player to win the tender, then it seems to me they might be willing to give up a couple of things where they know they've already got a dominant solution. IPTV over fibre will be very good. But I do accept the comment, incidentally, Alan, that We are favouring a much less regulatory model. I'm favouring in my paper. But I think that then gives Telstra an awful lot of leverage with its fibre cable and the fibre system, and therefore it's not a bad idea to allow another competitive structure to emerge to undo the damage of a very bad period of Australian regulatory and investment experience.